Monster Man, special episode, Other Vampires. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon supporters. This one is a little bit out of normal order. I didn't have a request yet from the next person in line, and so I sent out a word to some of my longtime backers who would be normally awaiting their second episodes, and the first one to get back to me was Robert Gordon. And Robert asked me to talk about vampires, citing our early history. He and I actually met through Vampire the Masquerade. You know, we used to play in a live-action Vampire the Masquerade game together. If you'd like to be like Robert and get me to talk about vampires, then all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And when you do that, you'll get first occasional bonus content, like an episode I've got coming up, hopefully this week, might be next week, about deities from other fantasy role-playing games. You'll get access to my bonus podcast, Patron Deities, in which I talk about deities and demigods, the D&D supplement, and religion and fantasy RPGs in general. And you'll get to choose a special episode just like this one. So Robert asked me to talk about vampires, and I want to talk about a couple of examples of vampires from medieval literature, and then after that, I'm just going to freewheel. We're going to see what we can do about including vampires in your Dungeons & Dragons game who aren't Clokey McBalcony, because I feel like that guy is done. Like, if you want to include Dracula-esque vampires in your D&D game, you're golden. So let's see if we can incorporate some other types of vampires. What say? Let's start with the conventional vampire. Now, vampires in Dungeons & Dragons were covered way back in Season 1, and I don't know that I have necessarily anything else to say about them. They're a fascinating example of how a horror movie monster, or at least a gothic movie monster, can exist and function very effectively in what is overall a fantasy adventure game. And the most famous Dungeons & Dragons vampire is, of course, Strahd von Zarovich, the villain, question mark, from Ravenloft. And in 5th edition, that's Curse of Strahd, but it's, you know, I mean, it's Strahd in a castle in... Now, Strahd has a personality and demeanor and whatever that can be basically summed up in one word, Dracula. But honestly, it's more like three words, Marvel Comics Dracula. And I don't think that's a coincidence, you know, Tomb of Dracula was in its heyday, the famed Marv Wolfman, Gene Colan run that was going on in the mid-1970s, and this is a very active physical Dracula. He, you know, tries to steal the Paracosmic from the Silver Surfer, he fights Doctor Strange, and in its insertion of Dracula into a superhero universe, I feel like Tomb of Dracula, you know, achieves some of the same things as the presence of a Dracula in a fantasy adventure universe. But I like Marvel Comics Dracula. He's a bit over the top, but then aren't they all? And, you know, he goes around backhanding people and calling them dolts and saying bah when he's displeased with stuff. And, you know, he's great. I like him a lot. I'm looking here at, I think this is an issue of part of the Doctor Strange Tomb of Dracula crossover, the Montesi formula. So Dracula is hallucinating, and then some nice passersby, like, come by, and one of them puts, you know, takes Dracula by the arm and he says, "Are you all right, man? It's kind of cold to be sleeping in the..." And Dracula just throws him off him and shouts, "Claude, take your hands off me!" When Doctor Strange turns into a vampire and tries to fight him, he says, "You would speak thus to the Lord of Vampires? You miserable Claude, I've suffered enough for your rebellion." And then, you know, just like a Marvel Comics supervillain, he proceeds to throw Doctor Strange through a table while monologuing. Now, the vampire in its gothic form, the vampire not even so much post-Bram Stoker's Dracula, but post, you know, Bela Lugosi and post-Christopher Lee, is a creature almost completely defined by its weaknesses. You know, if you think of a vampire, the things that you think of are sort of ways to kill it, right? Stake through the heart, sunlight, crucifix, garlic, decapitation. I mean, decapitation kills most things. Fire in some versions. Vampires have well-known limitations, and that makes them less exciting in a fantasy game, because the structure of a vampire is, like, if you think about stories like Dracula, or even Varney the Vampire, Varney the Vampire includes a scene where one of the characters starts explaining what's going on to the other, and that includes the phrase, "Tell me, have you ever heard of a vampire?" I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what he says, right? So you know, in that period, the vampire is this, like, relatively obscure piece of Eastern European folklore. And so the structure of that vampire story is figuring out who is the vampire and then applying the vampire's weaknesses to it. So I want to go back and take a look at medieval stories that in some ways anticipated the later vampire, but look at how different these creatures are from the more or less standardized vampire of the 18th and 19th centuries. And I haven't yet read Nick Groom's book, The Vampire, A New History, but it is seems to be like a cultural history of the vampire, and particularly the way in which these kind of diverse, you know, medieval and early modern stories got turned into the relatively stock genre convention of the vampire, you know, through this Enlightenment lens that was able to think about monsters in that way for the first time, as these creatures of rules, like almost like they were medical conditions. You know, this is the time when we start seeing, you know, diseases with lists of symptoms. That's a Renaissance innovation. But prior to that, we get a lot more individual cases of, you know, the walking dead, the corporeal undead, as opposed to ghosts. But there aren't the same kind of codified rules that you get with the vampire of modern horror and gothic fiction. So if you had to pick one definitive trait of the vampire, you would say, I would think, that it would be drinking blood. And there's a paper by John Blair about the, you know, medieval English chronicle accounts of the Walking Dead, and that introduces quite a vampire-like creature. Now, I believe that this is the only text from medieval England that mentions an animate corpse drinking blood. This comes from the historian William of Newburgh, Historia Rerum Anglicarum. And this is Book 5, Chapter 24, Of Certain Prodigies. I'm going to skip through this, but I really do recommend reading the Prodigies chapters of William of Newburgh because they're really fun. The rest of it is just kind of typical moralizing. I mean, that's not fair. But the rest of it is more, you know, medieval history. But then he sticks in here every so often these little tales of wonders. And I've actually read a book that argues that some of these stories must be true, specifically the story of the Green Children of Woolpit, which I could do a whole thing about, on the grounds that William of Newburgh is such a reputable historian who would never make anything up, which is not the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, but I mean, it's pretty ridiculous nonetheless. So here's part of Historia Rerum Anglicarum, Book 5, Chapter 24, Of Certain Prodigies. Another event happened at the castle which is called Anantis. A certain man of evil conduct, flying through fear of his enemies or the law out of the province of York to the lord of the before-named castle, took up his abode there. He married a wife, to his own ruin indeed, as it afterward appeared, for hearing certain rumors respecting her, he was vexed with the spirit of jealousy. Anxious to ascertain the truth of these reports, he pretended to be going on a journey from which he would not return for some days, but coming back in the evening, he was privily introduced into his bedroom by a maidservant who was on the secret, and lay hidden on an overhanging beam over his wife's chamber. Thereupon, beholding his wife in the act of fornication with a young man of the neighborhood, and in his indignation forgetful of his purpose, he fell, and was dashed heavily to the ground near where they were lying. The adulterer himself leapt up and escaped, but the wife, cunningly dissembling the fact, busied herself in gently raising her fallen husband from the earth. As soon as he had partially recovered, he upbraided her with adultery, but she, answering, "Explain myself, my lord," said she, "you are speaking unbecomingly, which must be imputed not to you, but to the sickness with which you are troubled." Being much shaken by the fall, he was attacked with a disease, insomuch that the man whom I have mentioned as having related these facts to me, he says he heard it from a monk, admonished him to make confession of his sins and receive the Eucharist in proper form, but as he was occupied in thinking about what had happened to him and what his wife had said, he put off the wholesome advice until the morrow, that morrow which in this world he was fated never to behold. For the next night, destitute of Christian grace and a prey to his well-earned misfortunes, he shared the deep slumber of death. A Christian burial indeed he received, though unworthy of it, but it did not much benefit him. For issuing by the handiwork of Satan from his grave at nighttime, and pursued by a pack of dogs with horrible barkings, he wandered through the courts and around the houses while all men made fast their doors, and did not dare to go abroad on any errand whatever from the beginning of the night until the sunrise, for fear of meeting and being beaten black and blue by this vagrant monster. But those precautions were of no avail, for the atmosphere, poisoned by the vagaries of this foul carcass, filled every house with disease and death by its pestiferous breath. Already did the town, which but a short time ago was populous, appear almost deserted, while those of its inhabitants who had escaped destruction migrated to other parts of the country, lest they too should die. So the monk calls a meeting of religious men, yada yada. While they were thus banqueting, two young men, brothers, who had lost their father by this plague, mutually encouraging one another, said, "This monster has already destroyed our father, and will speedily destroy us also, unless we take steps to prevent it. Let us therefore do some bold action, which will at once ensure our own safety and revenge our father's death. There is no one to hinder us, for in the priest's house a feast is in progress, and the whole town is as silent as if deserted. Let us dig up this baneful pest and burn it with fire." Thereupon, snatching up a spade, of but indifferent sharpness of edge, and hastening to the cemetery, they began to dig. And whilst they were thinking that they would have to dig to a greater depth, they suddenly, before much of the earth had been removed, laid bare the corpse, swollen to an enormous corpulence, with its countenance beyond measure turgid and suffused with blood, while the napkin in which it had been wrapped appeared nearly torn to pieces. These young men, however, spurred on by wrath, feared not, and inflicted a wound upon the senseless carcass, out of which flowed such a stream of blood that it might have been taken for a leech filled with the blood of many persons. Then, dragging it beyond the village, they speedily constructed a funeral pyre, and upon one of them saying that the pestilential body would not burn unless its heart were torn out, the other laid open its side by repeated blows of the blunted spade, and thrusting in his hand, dragged out the accursed heart. This being torn piecemeal and the body consigned to the flames, it was announced to the guests what was going on, who, running thither, enabled themselves to testify thenceforth to the circumstances. When that infernal hellhound had thus been destroyed, the pestilence which was rife among the people ceased, as if the air, which had been corrupted by the contagious motions of the dreadful corpse, were already purified by the fire which had consumed it. These facts having been thus expounded, let us return to the regular thread of history. Well, okay. Now, it occurs to me that I might have read this section before. It's very familiar. I mean, I've read it before, but I feel like I might have read it on this show before, in which case I apologize for going on at such length about it, but it is fun. So, this gives us a very different type of vampire, right? So, the typical vampire in a gothic story is like on the model of Dracula, where you meet Dracula as a person, in the guise of a person, and then you eventually find out that he's a vampire, right? Structurally, it's a mystery. And that makes sense when you think about the vampire's weaknesses, that the challenge of the plot is figure out that the guy's a vampire, or if you know there's a vampire, figure out who's the vampire, and then apply the vampire-killing solution to him. But here, we have a vampire, and this seems to me to be more common in medieval European lore, that the shocking thing isn't, I mean, it's immortality, but not immortality in the sense of a human-like person who's just going to live forever, but that this person is supposed to be dead and then they come back. And that this is done by the devil, basically because this guy is a sinner. And notably a sinner who's kind of a victim too. We're not meant to see him sympathetically, but he's a bit of a sad sack. And so the devil sends this thing around. Interestingly, it says that it's full of blood, but it doesn't particularly say that it drinks blood, at least not in like biting people and drinking their blood. But it does say that it spreads disease. And you can certainly see the association of vampirism with disease. You know, they could be seen as a disease. And it was believed in the Middle Ages, at least and sometimes in places, that exposure to a rotting corpse could be harmful, right? That it gave off that the bad smell from a corpse was dangerous, which has the virtue of not really being true, but of giving a good piece of advice, which is, stay away from dead bodies if you can. Bury them quickly and in a hygienic way. But I feel like it works well for the vampire. You could have this kind of wretched, plague-carrying Nosferatu creature, which is wandering around the town, apparently just beating people up. It doesn't have an ambition. It's just out there punishing the world around it for the crimes committed against this guy. It also doesn't put up much of a fight when it's killed, so here again we see the trope that the vampire is vulnerable when it's in its grave. So if they had encountered it wandering around the town, it would have roughed them up, but they got it while it was sleeping. If this was a D&D game, I would have had those hellhounds defending its grave. Note also that nobody in this story is in any doubt about who the vampire is. So here we have a couple of additional vampire qualities. I really like the idea that it spreads a plague because it's a rotting corpse. I like the image of it being bloated and like a big fat tick full of blood. I think that's suitably gross. And I like the idea that it's just kind of like mean and cantankerous because it was a sinner when it was alive. What I don't want to wind up doing is creating any number of additional vampire subtypes to put into a Dungeons & Dragons game, right? I think what you want to do is create something not unlike the table, maybe not quite such an extensive one, for hordlings. Like, take this story, where it's not explained why one of the brothers happens to know that the body won't burn unless the heart is cut out. There's so much vampire folklore out there that you don't want to have a vampire in your game who is vulnerable to all of it. A vampire who's vulnerable to garlic and poppy seeds and fishing nets and sunlight and church bells and running water and is a vampire who is basically nothing but a mass of weird neuroses. Although it could be fun to have this whole thing of like, well, you know, why is this nobleman's manor set up so that there's no mirrors and there's no church bells and the da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right? I feel like what you want instead to do is have those all be things that could potentially be true of any one vampire. So this way you wind up with Vampire Hunter PCs who are sort of never exactly sure what kind of vampire they're up against until they do some investigation and experimentation. It could also be fun to come up with different explanations for vampires, although I'm not sure that D&D really supports all of these. In Knights Black Agents, vampires are separated into four categories. And this isn't the idea that all four of these exist in the game world. It's like when you start your game, you pick what it is that causes vampires. Are they supernatural? Like they allowed a cat into a room with your corpse, and so obviously it sucked out your soul, and now you're a vampire. Or are they damned? Like, oh, they made a pact with the devil to get immortality, and the devil tricked them by making them a vampire. Or are they alien? Like, you know, a vampire is an alien nano colony that infects a human corpse. Or are they mutants? And each of these has like a marker, like a thematic marker. So folkloric stuff, well, that's a supernatural vampire. Religious stuff, that's a damned vampire. Uncanny stuff, that's an alien vampire. And like medical stuff, that's mutant vampire. You know, so what kind of story are we dealing with here as it crosses over with the world of high-powered espionage? And then you come into like, well, okay, where do they come from? How did they spread? What are their powers? What are their weaknesses? And from all these different options, you basically build up your own custom vampires for your campaign. And every piece of vampiric folklore, because this is, you know, this is a game that's set in the modern day, every piece of vampiric folklore that the players have ever encountered exists in this world, but only some of them are true. Now, obviously, in the world of Dungeons & Dragons, you're going to lose some of this. Now, in the world of a fantasy game, you can't have that first stage of the vampire investigation in a modern game where everybody goes, there's no such things as vampires. You know, when you find someone and they're drained of blood, people are going to go, oh, that's a vampire. So now we just got to figure out what kind of vampire we're dealing with. It's interesting to me how some monsters get labeled vampires. The Chinese hopping vampire, which I, my understanding, although I am not an expert, my understanding is that that is not a creature from Chinese folklore. That is a creature from kung fu movies from the 70s and 80s. The Chinese hopping vampire, it sucks out people's life essence, I guess. And that's maybe a bit more like this creature here, right? That people get sick and die around it. I guess the other way to look at your new combo vampire would be to think about what the aspect of the vampire myth you want to focus on is, right? Because ultimately, you've got different versions of what is important about the vampire. So, you know, in some presentations of vampire characters, what's really important about them is, you know, blood-drinking parasites. Or in other ones, it's like cool people who only come out at night who have superpowers. That's ultimately kind of where something like Angel goes. Maybe it's the immortality thing, right? So, like, that's the Forever Night version, if you remember that show, where every case that this guy tries to solve has some connection with some other thing that he once encountered because he's a vampire, so he lived for a long time. It's not like being a werewolf, where fundamentally werewolves are about the idea of reconciling a human and a quote-unquote animal nature. You know, vampire comes loaded with multiple implications. And it seems that these medieval Walking Dead stories are more about the anxiety and uncertainty that surrounds death. That they have that sort of pathetic quality to them. They're monsters that you don't want the monster to catch you, but you also don't want to end up like the monster. And I don't know how easy that is to convey with modern players. Because remember, like I said, okay, obviously that vampire folklore doesn't exist in a D&D world. But it exists in the minds of the players, which is also where the D&D world exists. So as soon as people realize, oh, neck-bitten vampire, they're going to start thinking crosses, holy water, garlic, silver, etc., etc. And I think if you're going to have just one vampire, or if you're going to have a lot of vampires, but not like two, then you want to establish that vampires have these individual pathologies. It was this thing that caused that person to be turned into a vampire, and as a result of this specific curse, blah, blah, blah. You might do something like say that all these people are cursed by the master vampire, or even that there's some specific devil that goes around turning people into vampires, like the chaos god Vivamort in Glorantha, because that would explain why they're all different and why they're, like, suited to the individual. You know, this person's particular crimes created this particular version of vampirism, and it's very devil-like in that it contains this element of both a reward and a punishment. So the reward is you're not really going to die. The punishment is, well, you're a smelly plague corpse and you got to wander around, you know, bringing death to people. So, like, you can't ever really have friends again. You can't go back to your old life. You're surrounded by a deadly plague cloud. And then, as a response to the frustration of that, you know, you go around beating people up. So I feel like I feel like that's a good premise for a set of vampire hunters, right? Like, here's this devil, it has the ability to create vampires, it creates vampires based on individual circumstances, and that turns every vampire into a more complex mystery than just who's the vampire, stake, head, fire. Even worse, because in D&D, right, like, if you tool someone, like, if you know there's a vampire, and you're gonna do a prolonged mystery, that means that people have time to prep the vampire-busting spells. I would say that was a silver bullet against vampires, except that silver bullets might actually be effective. So there's a lot of different vampire folklore in the world. I know I only gave one or two examples. My old friend Alex Bliskovsky, who has written so interestingly about werewolves in the Middle Ages, told me that, is it in Lithuanian folklore that vampires have like a stinger as a tongue, which is a really horrid image, and I don't like it at all. But anyway, as I say, there's so many different pieces of vampire folklore. The way you want to do is just get you one of those big encyclopedias of vampirism or whatever, you know. They're like $4.99 in discount bookstores. And then you say, okay, well, you know, the vampire-making devil, we can even call him, you know, Dracula or whatever. Or maybe it's Strahd or maybe, you know, whoever. The vampire-making devil goes around the world and rewards stroke punishes particularly evil individuals by turning them into vampires. And maybe as you go on, you could even uncover some kind of, you know, the other thing about vampires is the conspiracy narrative. That's a very 20th century one. I guess it's present in Dracula to a certain extent, but the idea that, you know, a bunch of rich parasites are, you know, sapping the lifeblood out of the ordinary working man is, you know, has a rich vein in you know, in some more acceptable and some less acceptable metaphors. But here, yeah, the idea of like a secret cabal of vampires competing to rule the world is a staple of various other games, and one that I think you could even incorporate, right? Like, if all these people were exceptionally evil before they were turned into vampires, then presumably they all have diabolical goals of their own, and maybe even want to, you know, unseat their creator and ascend to archdevil status. And that gives you the, if you kill the master vampire, all the lesser vampires will revert thing as well. Only you, you know, you have to do it to an archdevil, so it's quite tricky. Well, like a medium-ranked devil, right? You're not going to get to a Duke of Hell with just vampires as your trick, but it's still a pretty good trick. Okay, so that's just a bunch of rambling thoughts on devils and a long reading from William of Newburgh, which may be a repeat, in which case I apologize. But nonetheless, I do think that there's some good stuff in here. I actually kind of want to use these vampires in my game now. I mean, you don't have too many vampires, but it would explain why there are so many vampires, and it wouldn't always be the same experience. I'm sorry that I didn't get a chance to read that, The Vampire New History, before I did this one, but I'm sure that I'll find some more good ways to turn someone into an authentically medieval vampire. Hey everybody, James from the future here. I just remembered that I don't know if I ever told the story of how I was playing in a vampire game set in the Middle Ages, and in that game, our characters, who were vampires in medieval Denmark, were all very concerned about how we'd heard that there was a vampire hunter coming to town. You know, somebody had been found, drained of blood, it might have been one of us, I don't remember. And this vampire hunter showed up and we all just, you know, laid low for days until the heat died down. And what happened was that this guy came in, he brought a white horse, he went into the graveyard, he led the white horse over the graves, and every place the white horse reared up, they dug up the body and burned it. And we all just went, oh, okay. And then he left again. So we were all terrified of this vampire hunter, but the GM was equipping the vampire hunter with genuine medieval beliefs about how to find the walking dead, which is a very on-brand for that game. I still remember it fondly. So that's our special episode on vampires. Robert, I know it wound up deviating a little bit from your initial request, but I hope that you enjoyed it anyway. And remember, if you'd like to be like Robert, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level, and you'll be able to choose a topic for your own special episode of Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons attribution license. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.